Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ecology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour, along with tonight's regular Friday night guest. In fact, we have so much to talk about and so much going on in the world. You all know what we've been talking about, and things are still kind of where they were, although the Supreme Court supposedly today was going to hear the case of Phil Burke's lawsuit demanding that Barack Obama produce some valid certificates. And I might mention, as a caveat, that I got an email from one of our listeners telling me that they heard Alex Jones mention the fact that John McCain also is in the same boat as Obama as far as not being a U.S. citizen, primarily because, according to Alex Jones, McCain was born in a hospital that wasn't built until, according to Alex, some 5 years after McCain's birth in the Panama Canal Zone. I wonder where he heard that. Actually, if he got the facts straight, and for those of you who don't understand that cryptic comment, obviously Mr. Jones read my article on John McCain's genealogy, and likely Barack Obama's. So I'm a bit flattered. It is at least 7 years after his so-called birth that the hospital was built. So I thought I would just make that correction and thank Yaya for sending me that story in an email. I guess that occurred a couple of nights ago. Hopefully you didn't hear that during my show. Anyway, moving right along, we're going to bring tonight's guest on board. He is a regular on Evident Footprints. He's done more shows than anyone else as a guest. He is our honorary science advisor. He is a scientist, which makes sense, an inventor, also an author, lecturer, and teacher, and somewhat of a comedian, definitely a patriot, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. I'm glad to be with you again. And you're right, we've done a lot of shows together, but you know what? It went so fast, and it became such a regular routine that I think we both look forward to. It doesn't really seem like it's been that long, but now that you mention it, it's been a while already.
Mm-hmm. It has. It's been well over a year and a half. Actually, you know, you started with me in June of 2007, and you've been there every week. You've done a show at least once a week, so my hat's off to you. And
well,
and I have
you
to say, also, the listening audience has a lot of positive things to say as well. So, just so you know.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm glad that we're getting some of the novel thoughts and unusual concepts across. It's always good to ingest new information and broaden your consciousness. And we covered that in our show, what, 2-3 weeks ago?
Yeah, actually, we've been on the third straight week of consciousness material. I did four solo shows this week, and I was sharing quite a bit about the spiritual side of things. This week, I focused on a writing from the Phoenix Journal, which is an accounting of the ministry of Esau Emmanuel, who we call Jesus Christ, and the actual scripture taken down by Judas Iscariot. And it's a very revealing, very truth-filled story. I leave it up to the listening audience to determine how much of that they want to discern. But there's a fundamental truth in that. And then last night I focused on the concept of love. Tonight we have planned to take that a step further and really kind of incorporate some of the things we've been talking about and even go up higher in consciousness or higher in vibration and talk about light and sound and their function in the universe and their relationship to us as living beings.
That's the plan. So
that was your cue.
Yeah, I got it. Well, as long as that was my cue, let's do it this way. It's all right with you. We'll do a little tiny review of the structure of man that we talked about a few weeks back, and then from there we can start off into the realm of the higher vibrations, which of course includes light and also various types of sound.
Okay.
So we are all familiar with the meat machine that we run around in every day. We call it our body. And, of course, that is made from gross matter derived from the planet itself. And through the miracle of our DNA and our body chemistry, it is slowly transformed into the body that we learn to love and enjoy as we grow. But the body is only the very bottom of the entire structure. And as we examine it in more depth, we find that the structure becomes more and more tenuous as we go up into the higher octaves of expression. And the next thing that we have, of course, is an astral body. And the astral body is composed of a strange substance known as ectoplasm, which is actually an energetic, plasmatic substance, not as dense as our normal body matter. And it's in the astral realm that the interactions of these various energies and the life force creates the aura that people are always talking about. And then, of course, above the aura, we have the mind. And the mind is where we accumulate information and knowledge and make judgments and what have you. If we go up another octave, we come to the source of energy for the entire structure, which is called the soul. And in the soul, of course, is a manifestation of the life force itself. And above the soul, we have the guiding force, which coordinates the entire structure from the top down, and that we call the spirit. And the spirit is actually a manifestation of light. Each individual has a complex interplay of frequencies and vibrations, which are definitely composed of various types of light. And if we could actually see the way we really look, you'd see an amazing light show, very similar to the Aurora Borealis. Only a lot more complicated, dancing around high above each of our mortal bodies. And if we go one step beyond the light, we come to the actual Godhead, the Creator, who is, of course, the purest and the most brilliant of the light beings. And therein lies a very interesting connection, because If the Great Spirit is light, and ultimately we are light, then obviously there's a connection there. And that's something that we shouldn't forget. because we are made in the image and likeness of God, and that is not necessarily expressed at the mortal level, but rather at the highest of the spiritual plateaus. And since God himself, and we touched on this once before, is a spiritual, energetic being that preexisted all else, it stands to reason that when he made the, and created the universe, he essentially used his own substance as the source of all creation. So, ultimately, everything is composed of light. And therefore, it makes perfect sense for us to consider the nature of light. And that will lead us into a real interesting series of investigations. Light is actually, of course, an electromagnetic vibration. It is, it was originally conceived as a longitudinal wave, very similar to a sound wave, moving through the ether of space. And there's a lot of controversy as to whether there's an ether or not. Einstein and the Michelson-Morley experiment and things of that sort tended to displace the ether in modern thinking.
Mm-hmm.
My personal feeling, though, Don, is that there is an ether, even if
I always say ether there is or there isn't.
Well, there you go. How can you go wrong with a statement like that?
Go ahead.
But anyway, either there is an ether or there isn't, but I think that there probably is, and the reason that it hasn't been detected is because the original concept of the ether was like a tenuous vapor that was made of tiny little particles, many, many thousands of times smaller than the atoms, but nonetheless matter. And it could well be that the experiments that were designed to detect it were designed to detect something that isn't there, because perhaps the ether is more like the substance described by Wilhelm Reich. It's actually an all-pervading energy form that fills all of space and manifests in many different ways depending on the octave of expression that you're investigating.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, whatever it is, if it's there, light travels through it, and the light, of course, has been defined in modern times as electromagnetic vibrations, and these electromagnetic vibrations cover enormous spectrum of activity. Now, it might serve a good purpose to interject at this point that there is really two types of basic vibrations. There's a type which you could describe as transverse vibrations, and that's what most people are familiar with. That's what you get if you tie a rope to a pole and you wiggle your hand at one end and you watch the waves go down the rope. That's essentially a transverse vibration. And its nature is such that it's a departure from a line of equilibrium, which would be represented by the rope, to an area above and below that, and then it forms a wave train which moves along. More interesting, however, is the longitudinal vibration. And the longitudinal vibration is more difficult to describe if you're not familiar with these things, but it's more like what you would have if you had water moving inside of a pipe in response to a piston going back and forth. Instead of it splaying out to the sides like the transverse wave, it would go backwards and forwards along the axis of the pipe. So those are the two different waveforms. Light, as we study it, is perceived to be a transverse wave, And actually, it's more than one wave. It's an arrangement of an electromagnetic wave, which is then orthogonally linked to an electrostatic wave. And the modern thinking is that these move through space by constantly changing from one type of energy form to the other. So first it's magnetic, then it's electric, then it's magnetic, then it's electric. And with that theory, they profess that the ether is no longer required. The most familiar form of electromagnetic radiation that we humans are used to enjoying falls into the range of the visible spectrum. And when I was a kid, I had a teacher by the name of Mrs. Mulhern, who was a very crotchety woman, and I didn't learn very much from her, but for some reason, the one thing that she taught which really stuck was an acronym to remember the name of the colors of the spectrum, and she called it the VIBGOR, V-I-B-G-Y-O-R. And if you spell that out, it's the first first letter for each of the colors in the spectrum, mm-hmm. starting with violet, indigo, blue, green, yellow, orange, and red. And then below violet, we have ultraviolet, and above red, we have infrared. And that constitutes the limits of detection of light for most of us, and probably for most of the creatures that accompany us on Earth. Those vibrations go from 400 nanometers to 750 nanometers between the violet and the red. And what's interesting, of course, is that while we actually live immersed in this incredible spectrum of light, and it gives us the ability to perceive all of the different things that we utilize in our lives, it's actually a microscopically small subdivision of the total electromagnetic spectrum. And Don, before we get into anything like that, I remember you talking on a couple of shows about the experiences that you've had with using both light and sound for healing purposes, and the nature of those vibrations are, of course, not easy to understand, but each frequency has a different ability associated with it. Like, for instance, the colors and the white light stimulates the retina of the eye and activates the rods and the cones so that we can see. The infrared gives us a sensation of heat. The ultraviolet, you know, can penetrate more deeply into the body and make changes in the molecular structures of the cells, which is why we have to be careful of too much exposure to it. But you're much more familiar with the other aspects that relate to healing, and I thought it would be interesting if you could touch on that before we go into the more complicated structure of the higher frequencies.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. If I could comment first, just briefly, on what you mentioned about the ether, it seems that every great scientist, inventor, Tesla, Schauberg, also Reich, who you mentioned, and there are a few others. There's one whose name isn't coming to mind. Let's say supported the concept of the ether. And Ken Adachi and I recently, within the past few months, have been working with some photographs. I think you'll recall these photographs where he was sent a photo of two saucers that were seen in the night sky, in Germany, and they were glowing orange, and there was a beam of light between the two craft, if you remember.
Oh, yeah. I remember that very clearly. Yep.
Yes. And we identified one craft as a gray craft being flown by gray aliens, and the other one was a reptilian craft. And the beam of light, which I discerned was a transmission of data between the two craft, was invisible unless you enlarged the photo and played with the actual light in the photo. And what we noticed was that there were manifestations of what we determined were negative entities, which were following the craft, much like dolphins or porpoises would follow a ship in the ocean. And the phenomenon became apparent. In other words, they're there in the sky, in the blackness of the night. You can't see them. And certainly in the daytime, you can't see them unless they have a medium through which they can manifest themselves. On 9/11, they did that in the smoke and dust clouds of the World Trade Center, and also at the Pentagon, the same entities appeared, hundreds, maybe even thousands of them, and they took on characteristics that resembled people, animals, and things that we've never seen before, but definitely had eyes, ears, nose, mouth, snout, hair, or in some cases they had physical objects even. So this concept of the ether would be a medium through which these things could move through space. Now, if the craft, it's unclear if the craft were in our atmosphere, but we'd have to presume that in a sense they were, and I would go on to say that they can move, if they can move through our atmosphere in that fashion, they can probably move through space. And so the atmosphere of space, which we normally call a vacuum, has to contain something. And I would say that it would be the ether. And that because we don't see it doesn't mean it's not there, just like air in our atmosphere. We don't see the air, we only see the contaminants or the pollutants. So, that said, you can comment on that if you want. That said,
right, I'm a believer in the ether. Intuitively, it feels right to me. The mm-hmm. problem is that identifying exactly what it is and learning how to do anything with it is a very daunting task. And quite honestly, I have been so engrossed for the last 40 years in understanding more fundamental aspects of the world of reality that I really haven't given a whole lot of thought in recent years to mm-hmm. to the ether or what to do with it. But I definitely believe that it's there, and as long as it is there, I think that you're absolutely right. Not only light can travel through it, but probably lots of other things. And,
yeah, electromagnetic energy, we know, from the sun, same thing. So,
sure, and even the entities you're talking about, we don't really know what constitutes a conscious being at that level of, what's the word? It's almost like a mist.
Manifestation?
Manifestation, yeah. I don't even know what you'd call it, but if there is something there at that level, who's to say how it gets around, you know, or where it derives its energy from?
Yeah.
So I always like to look at things from the standpoint or from the belief that there are so many things that we don't understand, and the universe is so vast and so complex that only a fool would actually venture to say that we're standing on real solid soil and we know everything that there is to know.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any kind of a sin of arrogance, that would certainly be it.
Yeah.
So
I agree. Well, to comment on your segue about the aura or the chakras, we we have, within the confines of our body, we have seven chakras. They're wheels of spinning light. And the areas where the light is focused has much to do with our function and our nature or our inner power. And, of course, all of this is also grounded to the earth. In fact, beyond the seven that we have in our body, and they move along our spine, basically, one is directly related to the life force or what is sometimes referred to as our chi. And we have a reproductive chakra. Women in the second chakra of the woman, and basically they move from the pubic area to the lower abdomen to the upper abdomen, or what's called the solar plexus, the heart, the throat, the pineal gland, and then the crown chakra. Then in some individuals, you'll see light shooting out in sort of a very chaotic way out of the top of the head, or you'll see what is referred to as a halo. And the halo is often depicted in religious photos because many of the prophets and the saints had visible halos as well as visible auras. Now, the aura would be the next aspect of color that surrounds the body, sort of if you could picture a wedding gown that's draped from the top of the head, flaring out, sometimes all the way down to the ground. The weaker a person is, or the weaker the light within them is, the closer that aura is to the body. And then there is the etheric body. So there is actually a body that I feel connects with the rest of the universe, and it's vibrating at least harmonically with the ether that's out there in space. And
that would be the same as the astral body that I mentioned, or do you think it's something different?
Well, the astral body is the aspect of us that is attached by the silver cord, which is generally in the navel area. You would consider that an umbilical cord, but it's a silver or a metallic light. Silver metallic sort of light. And unlike the physical umbilical cord, it stretches. It'll stretch out to infinity. When one dies physically, that just disconnects and lets go. And we take off. But when one is traveling astrally, one is actually just moving around in the light body, but perceiving things much like we do with our physical bodies. The difference is what we see can be influenced by our dreams, but a conscious out-of-body experience, one will see everything as it's actually happening. Now, that raises a whole set of other questions or hypotheses, because when we're in our bodies and we're experiencing life, some say that we are actually living in a hologram. So we are, in our experience, we're not in a reality here. We are in an experiential dimension, a three-dimensional world that is governed by certain rules that one can escape when one moves to a higher dimension. So in that sense, we are vibrating at a lower frequency than the other dimensions, and so certain of those aspects of the higher dimensions are unavailable to us until we awaken the light within the body and progress. And usually that's accomplished in the highest sense by operating through the heart, by discerning through the heart and communicating through the heart. I communicate with God through my heart chakra or the area of the heart. And that is also where my discernment lies. Even though when I'm visualizing something intuitively, I have the sensation of seeing it in the area of my third eye, in between and slightly above the eyebrows. Yet, I take that information and I bring it into the heart center and I discern it there. So it's sort of a series of filters and meters and weights, if you want to use that term, to discern what something might be. Now, it's very dependent on everything else being open and the energy flowing and even my physical body not being too tired, because anyone who is intuitive will tell you that when they're tired, it's difficult to focus on something. But under certain circumstances, when one is relaxed, one is not preoccupied, when one is not in fear, when one is vibrating at a higher vibration, those channels seem to be wide open, and then the information just flows. It'll do it for days at a time. Sometimes one needs to just step back and recharge the battery, so to speak. And what happens during that time is the chakras themselves increase their light intensity, and that fortifies the aura, and the aura not only expands, but it becomes brighter. Sometimes this is captured in pictures, just because it is so strong in an individual that it makes itself quite visible in an ordinary photograph, often in the Polaroid type of photographs, the Instamatic or the instant photographs that develop right out of the camera. It's an interesting phenomenon. We have three chakras that connect us to the center of the earth. They're below the body. And the mainstream metaphysical community would say that there are at least another two above the body. Yet I'm learning that there may be as many as 400 that go out into other aspects of the universe. So it's quite a quite an interesting creation that we are. And when you consider that most people aren't even aware of the seven chakras that are within the body, imagine what would happen if we just became aware of those 12 that I mentioned.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think one of the things that would happen would be that we would have a total expansion of not only certain avenues of consciousness, but also avenues of perception. Because mm-hmm. The visible light that brings images to our eyes and our brain represents such a small segment of the total universe that even though we look upon the gift of sight as being probably our most precious sense and certainly an extraordinary gift, what it allows us to see is minuscule compared to what's out there in the higher manifestations of light. And having introduced that idea, what I thought I would do is just run down a list of the different types of vibrations that we know of and touch upon their electromagnetic and acoustic properties. For instance, as long as we're talking about the eyes, visible light, which I mentioned before, is between like 400 nanometers to about 750 nanometers and constitutes frequencies from 4 times 10 to the 14th all the way up to 7.5 times 10 to the 14th hertz, which is, or cycles per second, which is a pretty high frequency. Especially when you compare it to the really lower frequencies that we're used to, like radio and TV channels, for instance. And yes,
you're saying like that's like the red would be 400 million cycles per second, I think.
You know what, Don? I didn't bother to figure out how many zeros I mean, 14 zeros, what number that constitutes, but it's way up there. Yeah, we could figure it out. I'd just take a pen or a pencil and actually draw 14 zeros and then, you know, knock it off in threes. But it's way up there. But it doesn't represent anything compared to the overall picture.
Yeah.
So if we start with what we can appreciate through our senses, for instance, starting at the very bottom would be the audio frequencies, which range, and you know more about this than me, actually, but ranges from, our perception of that ranges from about, I guess it's 7 hertz up to about 12 or 15,000 hertz, and that seems like a big range. But then elephants and whales go down way below the 7 hertz frequencies. I don't know how low they go. And then there are animals and insects which respond to frequencies well above our top limit, and that's just in the audio range.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you start off on a fairly similar level in the electromagnetic spectrum, you're talking about, let's say, alternating current that services our homes and what have you. That's oscillating at 60 cycles per second. Radio waves are a pretty broad spectrum. A lot of people figure that they start around 1,000 cycles per second, but they go all the way up to 100 million cycles per second, at least. And then beyond the normal radio waves, you've got microwaves, which are, they span from about the 100 million cycles per second all the way up to 100 billion cycles per second. And by that time, we're at the lower end of the visible spectrum, almost. We're into the infrared, which can go from 100 billion cycles per second up to 10 to the 14 cycles per second. Then, of course, there's that small slit in which we have the visible light excitation, which, as I said before, is approximately from 4 times 10 to the 14th up to about 7.5 times 10 to the 14th hertz. On the outer region of that expression, we find the ultraviolet, which goes from approximately 7.5 times 10 to the 14th all the way up to 10 to the 16th. And then that leaves us in the realm of X-rays. And X-rays, softer X-rays, start off at around 10 to the 16th and go all the way up to 10 to the 19th. And that leaves us at the threshold of gamma rays, which start at 10 to the 19th and nobody knows exactly how high up they go from there. So we're talking about being immersed in an incredible ocean of wave activity. And even though we have defined the visible light region to be our understanding of what light is, technically speaking, all of it is light. For instance, an X-ray is actually a form of light. A gamma ray, it can be a form of light. Infrared and ultraviolet are forms of light. Just because we can't see them doesn't mean they're not there. And it doesn't mean that they don't constitute an expression of light. So the reason I enumerated all those things, just imagine we get the most incredible sensation from looking at our world through our eyes, and yet it's a tiny, insignificant sliver of what's available in the total light spectrum. And if we were freed from the confines of this flesh, or even if we were still in the flesh and we could somehow activate the higher perceptions associated with the upper chakra that you described, imagine the richness and the incredible extent of beauty that you'd be able to perceive through those extended senses when you viewed the universe in its total vibratory spectrum. And I imagine that maybe that's the kind of thing that we experience after death, that you actually will look at, upon the whole of creation in a manner that you can't do in your life because the senses are so limited, but then you'll see this, the vastness and the most incredible display of the way things are created at all frequencies. Do you think that could actually happen, Don?
I think you're exactly right. I also feel that a shift into the fifth dimension would open up our DNA or reconnect our 10 or less strands of DNA that aren't activated, would cause them to be activated, and we would perceive many of these things. It's interesting, while you were describing these frequencies, I recall when satellite systems first came out, they had UHF remote controls, and if you wanted to adjust the antenna or the UNB, which is basically the receiving device of a satellite dish, then the LNB, whether you had a dual LNB or a single LNB, it could only be adjusted manually or when they came out with the UHF. What was interesting with the UHF remote is it would work through the walls and the ceiling. You didn't have to go outside to change it. So there are characteristics in the UHF realm, just in a remote control, that works through the walls, where the infrared type of remote control is dependent upon a direct line of sight with the receiver on the satellite receiver itself. You know, the remote is a transmitter, and the unit has an optical sensor that picks up the code that's being emitted from that remote control. The UHF goes right through the ceiling and does all the work without you even having to leave the confines of the particular building that you would be in. So it's I know one will do something that the other will not do. And
You know, our friend Tesla was one of the first people to recognize the importance of studying the entire vibratory spectrum. And even in the electrical realm, as I mentioned when I was going down that list, we're talking about 60 cycles, you know, being the frequency we're most familiar with. But naturally, you can also take the electrical oscillations up into the millions and possibly even the billions of cycles per second, even in a wire, before you go into the antenna to create radio waves. And each one of those frequencies also has totally different characteristics, the way they interact with matter and the properties that they have. And you wouldn't think it would be so, simply because you essentially have the same ingredient, but you're just shaking it at different rates, so to speak. And yet it's amazing how different each portion of the vibratory spectrum is. So I appreciate very strongly the remarks that you make, and I agree with you that it's just like another totally different world when you get into all of that.
Yes. Now, you were referring to the audio frequencies, and just for specificity, if I can clarify something, the lowest note on a grand piano, the low A, is vibrating at 27.5 hertz, or 27 and a half cycles per second. And we can hear an octave below that, and we can hear to an extent an octave below that. We can hear in that lower range. An earthquake generally oscillates at 1 to 2 hertz, or 1 to 2 cycles per second, and it emits a standing wave, which is the lowest of the frequencies, and standing waves move energy, and they travel long distances. Now, on the upper range, the average hearing is about where you said, 15,000 hertz, although it's quite common for people to hear higher than that. In fact, with the new digital technology, we're able to master or add what's called sibilance, which gives more clarity or a harmonic coloring to certain aspects of our speech. S's and K's and T's, for example, become clearer and crisper when we add sibilance. And that is usually anywhere from 18,000 to 20,000 hertz. Now, I've had my hearing measured, and I've heard on many occasions between 21 and 22,000 hertz. Dogs and cats hear up to 45,000 hertz. So they have that's one reason why dogs can hear things that we can't hear. And that's just phenomenal hearing range. They're basically hearing an octave or more higher than the average human. In some cases, it's three.
I'm sorry. What did you say? In some cases, it's what?
Well, in some cases, it's literally, you know, three times as high as the average human. So it depends on the species and the actual sound that they're listening to.
Yeah, I agree with that. I have a question for you though. When you talk about going down to these low frequencies, like the earthquake range, I'm not sure. I've never tried to listen to a signal that low, but I get the impression that you would almost feel it more than hear it. And I know from my personal experience that back in the 60s and 70s, when they first came out with the ultrasonic burglar alarms that they used to have in stores, which actually create a pattern of waves in the surrounding space between the transducers. And when a person walks in that area, if the thing is armed, it distorts that wave pattern and sets off an alarm. I could hear those things, but I honestly used to stand around in those areas and try to figure out if I was really hearing it or if I was detecting it some other way. And I used to look up at the transducer and slowly roll my head back and forth, side to side, like you would try to do when you're trying to triangulate a normal sound to get the exact point from which it's coming from. And it was the same no matter what I did. It didn't really behave like sound to me. And it was kind of an annoying sensation. But yet I knew it was there. And my mind automatically categorized it as a noise, even though I wasn't hearing it in the normal way.
Yeah,
now, I always found that to be a fascinating thing. Have you ever experienced anything like that?
Yes, actually, you're describing the principle that when you introduce that frequency of a sound or that low, it is possible to produce a sound out of a loudspeaker around the 2 hertz area. In fact, many years ago, I worked with producer Bob Todd in conjunction with Altec Lansing. We were developing the speakers for the SensorRound, what they called the SensorRound theater.
Yeah, I remember it. It was a theater sensation.
And this was in anticipation of being able to reproduce the low-frequency sounds in the movie Earthquake. And Altech Lansing had developed a woofer that could handle that frequency. But we had to use frequency generators to produce that sound. And when we got to waves of a particular amplitude or a particular volume level, things would move around the studio. Things would fall off the shelves because we were creating standing waves. We feel that, and to an extent we can hear it. I think what we do hear is the harmonics, and we hear the points where, let's say if you're using two oscillators and you get a phase cancellation, that will also produce harmonics and will produce a pulse of the energy. So you're kind of feeling that more than you're hearing it. And as it goes up an octave, then it becomes more audible. Definitely two octaves after later, it's actually in the area of where the earth vibrates. Some say that's roughly 8 hertz. Some have estimated it's more at 7.49 hertz. But
I rounded it off to 7, but I know what you mean. It's as a matter of fact, Tesla played in that area too, as you know.
Yeah. So you're feeling it, and because it's a standing wave, it's a wave that travels and has to be absorbed by something for the sound to stop. It'll keep moving. It has a lot of energy. It carries tremendous amounts of energy. When you consider just in an earthquake, and this is just for frame of reference as to how much energy is being dissipated, each tenth of a point on the Richter scale represents 63 times the amount of energy. Every tenth of a point, it climbs. So it's massive amounts of energy are being transmitted in a standing wave, and the louder it is, and depending upon the reflective surfaces in the environment where that wave is being heard, that wave can keep moving on and on and on. It can travel for miles, literally, which is what happens in an earthquake. Those waves can travel thousands of miles and be felt by everyone in that path. That's why you have these experiences of a quake in Los Angeles that they feel up in Seattle to some extent.
That's right. And incidentally, on the same note, now that you brought it up, Ivan Sanderson, when he was in Africa before World War II, was studying elephants, and the discoveries that he made regarding subsonic transmissions of elephants, which carries for hundreds of miles, and interestingly enough, they don't even hear it with their ears. They hear it with their feet.
Yes.
It's amazing that the diversity and the richness of all of this this vibratory world that surrounds us. Now, the same is true with whales. Somebody was just telling me this morning that part of the problem they've discovered with the whales and the populations of whales dying off, well, of course, they're being hunted to extinction, which is not fair either, but that doesn't enter into the immediate problem I was going to discuss. There's actually acoustic pollution in the oceans due to all of the stuff that we have running around the world, motorboats and submarines and ships and buoys and bells and God only knows what else is out there. And it's actually interfering with the subsonic calls that the whales use to locate mates. And so a lot of times they won't be able to find a male or a female to link up with to propagate their species.
Well, consider all the pollution from the satellite transmissions that are taking place. They're not just falling on the land.
That's true, too. Yeah, so there's an enormous amount of activity in the total frequency range, and we're oblivious to probably 99.9% of them.
Yeah, well, the significance of all this, whether we're talking about sound or we're talking about light or both together, is the impact that all this has on our makeup, both on a conscious and a subconscious level. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, now that you brought that up, I think it's a fair thing to just digress momentarily and talk about what actually happens in these higher frequency electromagnetic signals. Because once you realize that how they work, you also realize that they do more and have a greater effect than what you would initially estimate that they are capable of. So in order to do that, we have to backtrack just a little bit and go to something of a much more gross physical nature and say, supposing we have a wire that's carrying an electric current and we approach it with a magnet. Well, what happens, according to Lenz's law, is that wire is going to try to move one way or the other, depending upon the polarity of the current. Well, a very similar thing happens with these electromagnetic waves, including light. You have a shrinking magnetic field that gives rise to an electric field, and then when the electric field stops expanding and withers away, it produces a new magnetic field, and then that magnetic field goes through the same process and produces another electric field. And by this method, they kind of piggyback their way through space in the phenomenon that we refer to as a propagated wave. Now, when these waves impinge upon solid matter, what happens is, first the electric field comes into the material, and even though it's at a very high rate of speed and doesn't last very long, it's strong enough to displace electrons in the structure of whatever it impinges upon. And so that constitutes microscopic little currents that move in response to this penetrating electric field. And then right behind that, 90 degrees out of phase, comes a magnetic field, which also penetrates into the material while the current is still in motion. And the result, if you do the cross product of these two vectors, is that you wind up with a thrust or a force which is exerted against the solid material and in the direction of propagation. And this is referred to as the pressure of light. And anybody that has seen those little toys where you have a light bulb-shaped object with a little needle inside and a rotor that's made of black and white little vanes and spins when you put it in sunlight, you now understand what's making it turn. It's the pressure of light that's exerted by this exchange of electric and magnetic fields. So even though it's a very subtle force that you're not used to isolating and thinking about, the same thing happens when it hits your body. And this is just with visible light that we're talking about with this little radiometer toy. But also, all of the various vibrations that we just defined earlier are capable of this same type of mechanism. And the higher you go up in the frequency range, the more energy is associated with it. And the interesting thing is, not only does it work when light is absorbed by something, but it actually works when light is emitted by something. So if the nucleus of an atom decays and breaks down into a simpler form, usually the particles that are released are not all subatomic particles. You have the odd amounts of energy associated with that disintegration, which manifest as gamma rays. And when an atom disintegrates or breaks down by the emission of a gamma ray, it actually recoils, just like when you fire a rifle and you feel it hit your shoulder. As the gamma ray leaves the disintegrating nucleus, the remainder of that atom moves in the opposite direction in accordance with Newton's third law of motion. So interestingly enough, you can actually have a force-type reaction occurring between matter on one side and an electromagnetic radiation on the other side. And we know that it happens at both extremes of the experience, both when the atom emits this high-frequency burst and also when that radiation finally impinges upon gross matter somewhere else. It transfers that momentum through the pressure of light into that object. And the reason I wanted to spell this out is twofold, Don. First of all, we don't necessarily know or consciously comprehend all of the influences that affect our decisions, our moods, the way we think, all these things. And yet, you know, the astrologers may not be so wrong when they say that our makeup is reflected in the stars, because all this starlight that's emitted by the entire universe, a certain amount of that flux is reaching us. And during the course of our entire lifetime, certainly exerts some kind of an effect. And I like to call it the finger of God, because in the Ten Commandments episode, where they capitalized on this effect, they talked about how God delivered the commandments by the stroke of his finger. Now, Hollywood made it a literal thing that this hand of God was chiseling away at the rock, but I like to think about it that the entire universe, which is the way I perceive the deity, is in effect poking its finger at all of creation, us included. And as a result of that, there's no way we're not all connected. We're connected in so many ways that it's almost unbelievable. And it's a shame that we're not more cognizant of our own unity with the universe.
What comes to mind, Jim, is what a cell phone is doing, not just to the individual. You know, when you're talking about a microwave frequency, And the fact that we're also sending those frequencies out into space.
Yeah, I mean, it's the old story of everything affects everything, you know. And even though those radiations diminish as one over the square of the distance, so that by the time they're millions of miles from here, they're so small that they're imperceptible, it doesn't mean that they're gone. And all of that activity somehow combines to form this incredible background activity that is always present as noise in the universe. But that very noise, which they like to call the remainder of the Big Bang, that very noise forms a homogeneous mix that permeates all of creation and kind of binds it all together. So even in the chaos that we call noise, we find order, which is the creation that we live in. It's an amazing setup.
Now I wonder if we're sending those types of frequencies out, like I just mentioned, and you know, there's this saying in metaphysics that the good that you send out comes back thousandfold. I would presume that there's a converse or an opposite to that, too.
Well, there probably is. You know, maybe... But if the good comes back a thousandfold, what happens when you send out evil?
That's what I'm getting at.
You know, does the evil come back a thousandfold, or does the opposite happen? You know, hopefully it's the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so many laws that we know nothing about, and it's really amazing. I was just speaking earlier today with a friend of mine from L.A., and we were discussing this very thing. You know, the budget for the war effort and for mass genocide in general is hundreds of billions of dollars. And yet we don't know anything about what happens when you die, what happens when the soul enters the body at birth. We don't know anything about any of that stuff except what the sensitives tell us. And what would be wrong with taking one-tenth of the military budget and studying something as important as those things so that we can start to get some insights into the spiritual aspect of our natures? But lo and behold, powers that be feel that it's much more important to terminate life than to understand it, and so naturally the money is spent otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing so, we chip ourselves of our own heritage. Wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm. That's got to change, and I know in a sense that it is changing, which is why we're experiencing things the way we are right now. They're becoming rather frantic over the change that's rapidly taking place. Some refer to it as a quickening. It's definitely an indication that the balance is shifting in the opposite direction now. And they're they're going to grasp for straws as long as they can, and eventually, they'll just cease to exist.
Well, that can't happen fast enough for my liking.
Well, Jim, we're already out of time. This has been interesting. And it's worth pursuing some more if you're up for that. We could certainly...
Yeah, sure. There's oodles more to say on the subject, so I don't see why we couldn't do that.
Okay, well, then let's plan on handling that next week.
All right.
And it's time for us to say goodnight, so I'll say goodnight to our guest, Jim Murray. And you can go to my website, directlightproductions.com, click on photos. There's a whole section there of Jim Murray's photos of a power plant that he designed for Bethlehem Steel some years ago, as well as a few shots of a UFO that actually it's a flying saucer, but it's not flying. It was under construction at the time. And he graced us with a few pictures. Those are, again, at directlightproductions.com. And Jim will be back with us again next week. I wish you the best of a great weekend, Jim, and look forward to next week.
Thank you, Don. You too.
And I would like to also thank Don Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick for the sound, and most of all, the listening audience out there. And a special shout-out to Jill. I am not to forget that. In the meantime, I wish everyone a great weekend and a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.